Richard, the first thing I wanted to say about your fantastic book, How Sondheim Can Change Your Life, is that you've pulled a rather marvelous bait and switch, whereas the title suggests it's going to be a self-help book, of which there are so many on the shelves. And really, it's an intriguing, amazing, close read of Sondheim's great shows and lyrics. And so I applaud you.
Thank you. And Austin, it's great to be back with you doing another podcast. From Shakespeare to Sondheim, those two pinnacles of achievement.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 19th year, number 940, Sondheim Life Lessons. Professor Richard Shook, who joined me on the podcast back in April to talk about Shakespeare's House, his book about the history of Shakespeare's birthplace in Stratford-upon-Avon, returns for the second time in this year of our Lord 2024 to talk about his new book, How Sondheim Can Change Your Life. Richard's a theater historian whose recent focus has been on Shakespeare, but his new book is an excellent deep dive into most of Stephen Sondheim's musicals, at least the ones where Sondheim wrote both the music and the lyrics. And if you're a fan of musicals generally, or Sondheim specifically, you'll love Richard's insights into Sondheim's work, how it was created, how it's affected audiences for over 60 years, and yes, what life lessons can be gleaned from his shows. Richard began our conversation by telling me more about how his book, How Sondheim Can Change Your Life, got its title.
The bait and switch is kind of interesting because, as you know, authors don't really get the last word on the title. I suppose if you're Stephen King, you do. But the cover and the title are really up to the publisher. And the original title was, main title, subtitle, was Being Alive, Song Everybody Knows from Company.
Sure.
And then the subtitle was What Sondheim Can Teach You About Life, or something like that. So that was the title. I think all the way through up until the first draft was submitted. And then my editor, the wonderful Peter Borland at Atria Books, and he's the editor-in-chief at Atria, sort of presented it at the sort of national sales rep meetings. And he emailed me back and he said, there was a lot of love for Sondheim and for the approach you take in the book, which, as you've just said, are really a series of kind of essay close readings, show by show by show, from Gypsy to Here We Are. And Peter said there was a lot of love from the sales reps about the content of the book and the approach, but they really don't like the title. And they think it should be shorter and should have Sondheim. And they're the experts, right? It should be shorter and should have Sondheim close to the front, so that it is, they might not use the phrase bait and switch, but what they would say is that it is irresistible to a reader, consumer, purchaser, gift buyer, that you will want to pick up a book whose title is How Sondheim Can Change Your Life. And with that wonderful Ken Fallon channeling his inner Hirschfeld drawing of Sondheim on the cover. So you're intrigued by the packaging, and then you open it, and then it's pretty clear what is going on.
Yeah.
I'm glad that has worked because the book was reviewed in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, I think about a week ago, and it was overall a very positive review. But it started with the worst thing about Richard Shook's book is the title. Title is very misleading. So ignore the title, but when you get to the content, it's very interesting. So people are having different opinions about that. But the good news is when they get to the content, they seem to like it.
Well, I think irresistible is a much better phrasing.
It's important to know what you are not writing as right. well as what you are writing. And I knew from the beginning that I was not going to write a biography. I'm not a musicologist. As you know, I'm a theater historian. I'm not a musicologist, so I was not going to write a serious musicological book. Mm. It's not an interview book. I actually never met Sondheim, never even wrote to him. It's not a sort of behind the scenes theater anecdotes, coffee table book. It's really, and all those kinds of books are out there and they're all wonderful. But I thought there really is a gap here for people who like Sondheim. And it is essentially an appreciation for how the works of Stephen Sondheim can move us, change us, affect us. It's not just the beauty of the cleverness of the lyrics, the beauty of the music. It's the impact, the emotional resonance that those works have for us in a way that Shakespeare does as well, and why we keep returning to them. So it was the image of the loop from the stage to the audience and back to the stage, how the works sort of pass through us. And in a sense, in the way we remember these works and sing the songs ourselves in our head, that we are ourselves merging with these performances or bonding with the work. So it's that intimate link between the work and the audience that I really wanted to focus on and try to get some purchase on in the book. And I think I have.
You really have. And it's one of the glories of the book is that's exactly what it accomplishes. It's reading it is like revisiting not only the text and the score as you've heard it on recordings, but how the text and the score lands on stage to an audience.
Exactly.
And I think that's an approach that Sondheim would have really appreciated, because he was about the words. He and I didn't agree on everything, but one thing we did agree on is that we preferred actors who can sing rather than singers who can act, because that words are key. Lyrics are vital, and it needs to land on the audience. And so this revisiting, you made me rethink so many shows. I'm not as big a fan of company as many people are, but you made me look at it anew, which was, it was lovely.
Austin, that's so kind of you to say. I mean, said every author wants to feel that they've had an encounter with their reader. And, you know, with actors, you know, you get your audience right, stage actors, you get their audience right there, and you know whether it's landing or not. But with authors, you really don't. So it's nice to get that, I use the dreadful word, feedback from you, get your response as a reader. I know you were talking about Sondheim wanting, and you're absolutely right, actors who can sing, not singers who can act. And the day we are recording, we're recording on the 9th of December, and it is Judi Dench's 90th birthday.
Wow.
And she, of course, is still famous a quarter century and more, known nearly 30 years later for Send in the Clowns, which I heard her sing at the National Theater back in 1995. And although she's done musicals, no one thinks of her as a musical theater actress primarily.
She was the original British Sally Bowles in Cabaret.
She was the original. It's astonishing. And she really was the original Sally Bowles in Cabaret.
Yeah.
Way back.
Yeah.
In the 60s. But those are really sort of the two musicals that she's done. But of course, Sondheim had admired her approach. And she's on record as saying, I approached Send in the Clowns as a classical monologue for an actress. Because what else would you do? And if you watch these videos, they're all on YouTube of Sondheim doing his master classes at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. And they're really wonderful. And he was a great, great teacher. But you listen to what he says to the students. And these are music students. And he never talks about the music. He never talks about the notes. He only talks about the acting, and especially the pronunciation of the words. There ought to be clown. And you have to hit t, otherwise it doesn't work. So right. He was fanatical, maybe not too strong a word, but as you've said, you really had to get the words right. Yeah. But he didn't really care so much if you missed a note, because that sort of thing happens. But, you know, God help you if you got the lyric wrong. We're also just speechless because we know how ferocious Sondheim could be if he was unhappy with you.
Right. I never met Mr. Sondheim, but I did exchange communiques with him. And I know that he was concerned about his legacy. One of the questions I want to ask, because I don't know his later scores as well as I know his earlier, funnier stuff. Do you feel like it in his later shows, his desire to make his meaning clear led to more pedantry in his songs, more overt explanations of his themes and meaning? I'm thinking of two songs, Children Will Listen and Into the Woods and Something Just Broke in Assassins, which feel over-explanatory to me in a way that feels unnecessary and reductive and not in a good way. Or am I just misreading it because I'm disgruntled?
Well, I suppose, you know, with Into the Woods, I think the fairy tale genre lends itself to a certain kind of, and here children is the moral of the story, to a certain kind of didacticism, which Sondheim is on record as saying he loathed. But I think when you have that kind of template for the story, it's almost inevitable that there are going to be these slightly preachy moments. And I think it's also true, and I have no privileged information, but I know that James Lapine, if you read his book, Putting It Together, is kind of on record about the real message of that show being communion and togetherness, community, togetherness, and responsibility, which can then feel a bit heavy on top of the actual events of the show. I don't think anyone would dispute the value of that message, but when you sort of put these things together, it can feel a bit intense. And Something Just Broke from Assassins, there are funny moments, lots and lots of humorous moments in Assassins. Charlie Gâteau, Sam Bix, this is Weidman who wrote the libretto, but his those monologues into his tape recorder. But Sarah Jane Moore and in the gun song, you know, shit, I shot it. You know, she's fumbling with the pistol in her handbag. So there's plenty of humor in Assassins, but something just was added for the Donmar production at the behest of Sam Mendes, the director, then the artistic director. After Lee Harvey Oswald, as a kind of, and JFK's assassination, I think the quote was a chain of grief or chain of mourning, to somehow give the kind of overview or stitch it all together. And I was just having a conversation here in London the other night about someone who also really did not like that song. And for me, the song works, but it works sort of in spite of how it is supposed to work. For me, the song works a very strong indictment of the bystanders who don't want to be bothered, don't want to ask too many questions. And you get this brilliant Sondheim lyric in Something Just Broke. And the lyric is, fix it up fast. No problems, please. Don't trouble the happy, contented bourgeois surface. There are no problems in America. We have no structural issues about oppression and exclusion and discontent. And whenever there's a problem, let's not ask, why is there a problem? Why do people keep shooting each other? No, let's just fix it up fast and move on. So for me, that song is deeply powerful, not as a chain of grief, but as a chilling indictment of how and why, this seems to be the show's perspective, American culture seems not to want to know, and not even to care too much either, why political violence is so deeply woven into the social fabric. I think Assassins is, well, there is a very clear reason why Assassins is received a lot better in the United Kingdom than in the United States.
Yeah.
Because it is a very uncomfortable perspective on American history. And it seems perennially relevant when this summer, the president-elect, there was an assassination attempt on the now president-elect, Donald Trump. I think Assassins will go down as a masterpiece.
It's one of my favorites. And I told Mr. Sondheim it was one of my five Desert Island Discs, the OBC of Assassins. He didn't seem to care about that one bit. And I love your explanation of that song in your book. It's one of the many great insights in the book that I took away. I guess I didn't do that close of a reading of Something Just Broke. To me, it seemed to suggest that, oh, something's aberrant. It's instead of fundamentally wrong. I wish it was had a different title, that song.
Well, it's interesting, you know, and Sondheim himself talks about this, which is live in the moment of the theater, you have one chance, you know, a 3, even a 5 minute song, that's your chance, which is why he said the difference between poetry and song lyrics is poetry, you can go back, but who goes back to read a song lyric?
Right.
Of course, for this book, I had the luxury of revisiting in my head for weeks and months all the songs and all the lyrics, but in the moment of performance, there just isn't time for those ideas to penetrate as deeply as they might, which is another way of saying why decisions made by directors, designers, and actors are so crucial to how the performance presents itself, because all that work, that interpretive work that takes time, the artistic team can and should do as they conceive what the production is going to be. In other words, the song isn't just sung. It's sung with intent, with a slant, a point of view. So it's already starting the interpretive journey.
Hi, I'm Lewis Byard, the author of such novels as The Pale Blue Eye, Mr. Timothy, and Jackie and Me. And you, you lucky cuss, are listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Enjoy.
Where can you RSC the RSC? Tonight and tomorrow night, as this episode posts December 10th and 11th, 2024, we're performing the ultimate Christmas show abridged at the South Padre Island Convention Center in Texas. And then next March of 2025, we'll return to the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts for the 3-week Lort Theater premiere of The Comedy of Hamlet, a prequel. Check out the touring page at our website, ReducedShakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Richard Shook, talking about his new book, How Sondheim Can Change Your Life. So, yes or no, is Sondheim the new Shakespeare, our current Shakespeare, our modern Shakespeare?
Well, you know, I didn't, as you know, and as some of your listeners may recall from our Shakespeare parody and Shakespeare's House podcast, I am primarily a Shakespearean. This is the only book I've written on musical theater, but you know, but no less an eminence than Mandy Patinkin, who has acted Shakespeare and acted Sondheim, has said Shakespeare. He said Sondheim is the Shakespeare of musical theater, but it works the other way around as well. Mm. And it can sound like a a glib question because they are the names everybody knows and they're kind of alliterative in a certain way. So it can sound predictable, but I think it's a totally legitimate and insightful question and worth pondering because they are pinnacles of achievement in their respective genres, lyrical theater and, you know, and tragedies and comedies, histories, romances, all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. And you then have to ask yourself, well, not how does Sondheim copy Shakespeare, because that's not the question. It is, what is the commonality? You know, what is identical or operating in the same way in the works of Sondheim and Shakespeare? And in a way, it's what we talked about with Assassins, that whatever you are going through, whatever you are feeling or fearing or hoping or praying for or being or celebrating, Shakespeare has a thought about that and has a character who's going through that. And so does Sondheim. The range of human experience set to words and music is beyond parallel. And that makes, and I sound like an old, you know, English lit fuddy-duddy, but I think it's true. It's what makes these works evergreen, meaning ever growing, ever fertile, not dry and dead and desiccated. They are alive and nourishing and nurturing because they continue to offer us something. And it's our response to those works in that cycle from the stage to the audience and back to the stage. It's our response to the invitation of those works that, again, that keeps them fresh and alive. And the same with Shakespeare, and not just museum pieces that we can venerate. So I never have a problem either with Shakespeare or Sondheim with people saying, oh, but she didn't sing like Patti LuPone, or it wasn't like Glen Cariou, or I didn't like the director's concept. Well, that's okay, right? But this is a production for here and now, and there will be other production. It's like some people getting upset about Audra McDonald. She's now in previews for Gypsy on Broadway as Mama Rose. I think she is only the fifth person to open a Broadway production of Gypsy, you know, and already, you know, the chat, or to give it the Twitter term, the discourse is that, well, how can Audra do Gypsy? You know, she's a lyric soprano. It's written for an alto. And I haven't seen the production, but I'm looking forward to it. And, you know, and the answer is, well, she will do it her way.
Yeah,
which of course is very much Madame Rose, who does everything her own way. Audra will give us is giving us her interpretation of Gypsy, and whatever that interpretation is, it's going to be wonderful because she's a great actress. And it would be completely anti-theatrical to expect her performance or anybody's performance to be an imitation of a bygone performance. That is the death knell of theater, when we are simply replicating past productions. And I would say that's, in a way, that is more true of Shakespeare than of Sondheim. But even Sondheim is susceptible to the vice of deference. I'll coin that phrase right here, right now, the vice of deference.
Boy, that was such a better answer to that question than it deserved. Thank you. I could almost end it there, but I feel like I must ask, to bring us back to the beginning, did you, with your book's new title, did you have to change or adjust your writing at all to suggest life lessons at all? And a follow-up, Mr. Shook, how did Sondheim change your life?
Thank you for that two-parter. I did not have to change a word of the text.
Great.
Because the change in the title came very, very late in the process. The only thing I did was, after I submitted the first draft, and there was a second draft and a third draft, but they were not fundamental reworkings. They were fine tunings. So nothing really changed structurally. The only thing that I added once we had the new title was the subtitle for the chapters that is How to X. Like, so Gypsy is How to Be Who You Are, Follies, How to Survive Your Past. So to give it that kind of spin on, well, you know, here's the life lesson takeaway for you, or at the very least, here's the central theme.
Right.
But I think those are the themes. The theme of Gypsy is how to be who you are, which is what, and that is how Louise gets to be Gypsy, which is the person she really, truly is. That's her transformation, which is why in my chapter on Gypsy, I actually focus on Louise more than on Rose.
As you should, as one should.
It seems to be that's as one should. She is the title. She is the title character. So nothing really changed in terms of the writing. As for how things changed for me, you know, someone asked me, how long did it take you to write the book? And I said, 9 months and my whole life. Because I've been living with these works since I was a teenager. So in some way or other, they've been giving me sort of equipment for living or examples of how to confront life's challenges. But I mean, Austin, you know, I'm an academic, I'm a writer. You've seen me at the Folger Shakespeare Library. I live in a world of abstractions and ideas, and it's a solitary life. Except when I'm in the classroom, it's a solitary life. And it was certainly a deeply solitary experience to write this book. And one of the lessons I learned for myself in revisiting the works of Sondheim, which is how much I need, and this will sound almost like I'm going to be a brand ambassador for Into the Woods, but how much I need No One Is Alone to be true, and how deeply important that is. And it was a way for me to acknowledge that, as much as I am proud of all the solitary work that I do, you know, even a fussy introvert like me, I still need family, friends, love, connection. As the assassins say, connect, 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 right? They go about it in a crazy way, but that is a fundamental human need. They want to be worthy of your love, as John Hinckley says. So it was a wonderful reminder for me that I am more than just what I do on my own. And that was a good lesson to learn.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Richard Shook's new book, How Sondheim Can Change Your Life, is the perfect gift for the musical nerd on your holiday gift list or the person who just loves good writing about the theater. It's available wherever you get your fine reading matter. Send us your matinees and Pinter plays via email to feedback@ReducedShakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, ReducedShakespeare.com, or visit my website, TheShakespeareans.com. Thanks as always to One-Eyed Boatman Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Allison Stockford. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to novelist Lewis Byard, whose recent novel in five acts, The Wilds, is also available wherever you get your fine reading matter. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 940-2820th of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Richard, thanks so much for this conversation, and really thanks so much for the book, because it is, as what you were just saying, it anybody who reads the book will be part of this community that you are talking about, that we all want to be a part of. So thank you and congratulations.
Thank you, Austin, for your kind words, and it's great to be with you and your listeners.
This podcast is a production of the Reduce Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reduceshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less.